You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job. At the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock. Mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dan Carlin. Dan Carlin is a podcaster and political commentator. Once a professional television news reporter, author, columnist, and radio talk show host, Dan eventually took his show to the internet, where he has hosted two popular independent podcasts, Hardcore History and Common Sense, where he entertains millions of listeners. He has a new book. It's called The End Is Always Near, Apocalyptic Moments from the Bronze Age Collapse to Nuclear Near Misses. Dan Carlin, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was reading your book last week, and someone stopped me and asked what it was about. So I'm gonna tell you what I said, and you can let me know how correct or not I was.
Okay.
I said that it's a book that uses history as a way to think about the human condition as it is, as it was, and as it might be in the future. Close?
I think that's a great description. It's a strange book because when I first started the process, somebody told me that any good book should have an argument and then set out to prove that argument.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, then I'm in big trouble. I said, because that's not how I operate. I come from this from a journalistic background, and so I'm more about the questions than the answers. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the questions I like to play with have no answers.
Right.
And so the book is sort of hard to define in that sense, because there's no question, there's no answers. There's stories, and there's stories about people, and they're people who have lived through things that have happened over and over again. And it's a look at that as a way to sort of juxtaposition our own lives and say, if those things, let's just take one thing, a terrible pandemic.
Yeah.
These are a normal part of the historical rhythm of human life up until recently. Either we'll have another one or we won't. If we did, what would it look like? What could we learn by looking at some of the past examples? So I thought your description, actually, I should put it on the book sleeve. It was so perfect, I think.
Good. I will email it to you later.
Perfect.
You actually say, too, in the book, quote, I have always felt that my looser role as a student of history rather than an expert gives me some freedom to roam intellectual spaces that modern academic historians should probably avoid. It's really interesting, and it jives with something, you know, we work at Second City with the University of Chicago, and, like, you couldn't find two more opposite institutions. I mean, we just want to do it, and they want to study it, and they need to – your language needs to be precise, and we're all about non-precision. But it's somehow in that tension between those that I think a lot of cool stuff bubbles up, and I think that's kind of what you're talking about.
Well, when I was a kid, and you could still find some really old histories at that point – you would notice that by today's standards, they would bleed into a realm we would consider more like philosophy than history. And Thucydides, the ancient Greek historian, said that history was philosophy taught by example. Mm. But that's not the kind of thing a modern historian would say, because a modern historian is practically a scientist. They deal with quantifiable things that can be written up in peer-reviewed papers. I mean, in other words, they come up with a hypothesis like a good book should be. Didn't I just say that?
Yep.
And then set out to prove it. But there are certain questions that a historian from 100 years ago would have considered to be the kind of question you would ask a historian about. For example, do tough times make tougher people? And does having tougher people overall make any difference at all? Well, 100 years ago, a historian would have had no problem saying something, and today a historian would point out that those people were probably wrong and not study it, because how would you even quantify it? How would you – I mean, toughness even needs definition. And yet that doesn't mean it's not important. That doesn't mean it doesn't somehow play a role in our lives. But who the heck studies that these days? So I always thought that the realm I kind of played in was this sweet spot between what old historians used to consider part of their realm and what new historians wouldn't, because there's no data, there's no test, there's no mm-hmm. hypothesis, there's no proving anything.
So let's talk about toughness, because we had just recorded a podcast with Megan Daum, who's a feminist writer in her late 40s, and it was initially going to be this critique of contemporary feminism when Hillary Clinton was elected president. Well, that didn't happen. It is still a critique of contemporary feminism, but also a self-critique. And one of the things she says about her generation, which happens to be my generation, X, is that we grew up sort of proud of our toughness, and she sees this current generation coming up being sort of proud of their thin-skinnedness and more interested in fair, what's fair. You look at toughness. I mean, again, those generations are so close. You know, you're going back to like Sparta, where like babies were judged if they were tough enough to live. And that's a real thing? That's something that happened?
Oh, yeah. And the reason to do that is to try to find the extremes, right? You get your baseline right away. What's the most extreme version of this toughness thing? And it's like an ancient version of eugenics, right? We're only going to have the strong survive, and we're only going to start with the best material, and then we're going to have a culture that molds the clay from there. The reason we brought it up is it's proverbial. So you and I are from the same generation, then, if you're from Generation X.
Yep.
When we were kids, there was a general understanding that the people who grew up in the Depression and the Second World War were tough, right? So whatever tough means, you have to identify that too and define that, because do we mean warlike, or do we mean able to withstand privation, or what do we mean? Mm-hmm. But we always thought, okay, generally those were tough people. So I sat down once and thought, okay, but what does that mean, and how do you measure it, and does it matter? And do if tough times make tough people because you need it, do we need to be as tough today? Maybe you need a different skill set. You know, we're not dealing with saber-toothed tigers and cavemen anymore. Maybe we have a different level of toughness. And not just different level of toughness, but is there trade-offs? If you have a Spartan society, do you lose something in the process that we're allowed to indulge in now because we don't have to be that tough? Does that make sense?
Totally. And you also bring up this idea, is it individuals who are tough, or is it a generational kind of toughness and resiliency that happens when you survived, I don't know, like, you know, the Blitzkrieg or the bombing over, you know, London. And I have, you know, elders who went through those experiences, and I think of them as tough.
The problem with human history when we're talking about quantifying or peer review or data or radiocarbon dating or all these things that are so scientific is there's still that one quality that's so hard to fit into that box, and that's the human part of human history. And this toughness question is just one of many that falls into that category of for example, the Greeks thought the Spartans were tough. Mm-hmm. Would an Aztec, if you could have transported them and put them in the same room, think they were tough? I mean, all of these things are graded on cultural curves. But if you're looking back at Greek history and you said, does the collective toughness of Spartans in the Spartan state matter to their time period and the way their history turned out? All the other Greeks did. Can you quantify it? No. How do you fit that round peg into the square hole? I don't know. But the point of the story was you can't just say it doesn't matter at all either. So there's some weird netherworld of this matters. We can't say how. We can't measure it. But a human being would say, I grew up around the kids of the generation that went through the Depression and World War II, and I can tell you anecdotally that they were tougher than I am. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that naturally leads you to consider childhood, which you do in the book, and you write, quote, once upon a time, it was considered good parenting to teach your children a moral lesson in right and wrong by taking them to witness public executions. That would seem barbaric, to use a word that we will talk about later, to contemporary generations, I would think.
Well, you know, it's funny because I keep wondering if there was some useful reason, right? If you assume, and we can't, but if you assume that parents always want to do best by their children, mm-hmm. what were they thinking they were doing for them by showing them that, right? I like it as an example of the power of culture, because if you took an infant today back in a time machine to that era, and they grew up in that time, they would probably like to watch public executions too. So it shows you those first two chapters, the one on toughness and the one on child rearing, those are about human plasticity.
Yeah.
So we talked about, you know, we're so famous for our adaptability. So we're looking at how much we think we could adapt to some of the future challenges that the book deals with, everything from systems collapse to pandemics to nuclear war to all that other stuff.
I guess it's also important to note that, you know, this is, you know, we become myopic because we think things are so way farther back in the future. But like you note in this book, and I knew this, but in putting it in this larger historical context, it wasn't until the late 1930s that the United States actually created child labor laws. Like prior to that, the way we treated children was very different than it we conceive of as a modern state of childhood today.
I think it falls into the toughness category a little bit, that it's one of these things that when somebody brings these facts to your attention about how children were raised in the past or all these kind of things, you look at it and you're just appalled and you know that this must be important, right? Like somehow, because for example, if you found out that every child in a certain culture met our standards today for abuse, and then if I asked you the follow-up question, do you think this made some kind of difference in the big picture? How could you answer no, right? Mm-hmm. Well, some of these people who look back in the past hold the mirror up to our society and say, by our standards today, most of these people in the past would be seeing psychiatrists today. Yeah. Does that manifest itself on a society-wide level? Can you say that the Middle Ages were so brutal because it's an entire society run by child abuse victims? I don't know, but those, again, are the kind of questions. How would you test that, right? How would you have a peer-reviewed journal that somehow measured the ramifications of that? It's often that nether world that we can speculate about, a journalist like yours truly can ask questions about, but there are no answers. But the questions themselves, I think, are both fascinating, and I think the ancient philosophers might have thought that meditating about such human things has a value all by itself, you know?
Yeah. And then, you know, I'm right around this point in the book, chapter 3, I was kind of going, where are we going with this? And it wasn't until I finished the book that I started to see this arc, at least in my mind, that you were preparing the reader to think about various ends that have happened that we maybe need to consider in an existential way today for ourselves because it seems inevitable based on history. And really, to me, it's just all kicks in with this the stories around the collapse of the Bronze Age, which happened in what you call relatively quickly, because the relative is really important. Take us through a little bit of the stories that you know surround this chapter, because it really is. I don't think, unless you're a student of history, you don't think about the world in those days of having these sort of dynastic, you know, fully functioning societies that then like all went away.
You know, I tend to think of history as being like a fork in the road, right? And on one fork is everything will happen as it's happened already. And the other fork in the road is things will never again happen the way that they've always happened. So if you take something like the collapse of the Bronze Age, which you just brought up, either a society-wide collapse like that will happen again, or it won't. And either one of those eventualities is fascinating for its own reasons. The Bronze Age collapse is really interesting because first of all, nobody knows why it collapsed. And what the Bronze Age collapse was is about, and there's huge dating questions, but let's just play with 1200 BCE as a rough era that's somehow in the middle of that era where a whole functioning system based around the Mediterranean and the modern Middle East had something terrible happen to it. And some societies were completely destroyed and disappeared. Others were weakened. There were massive changes in the region, geopolitical, environmental, maybe volcanic activity and other tragedies. So we went through this system like a detective and tried to figure out, okay, if this were a crime scene, what would you figure out caused the end of the Bronze Age? And went through some of the ideas. And by the way, I'm not a historian, so these are ideas that historians and experts have gone through for years, and we just sort of lay them out for you so you can look at them and say, hmm. And the funny thing about all of them is almost all the causes are things that could affect us in a similar way today. And that's kind of what you hope people get, is that if it can happen to them, we're either immune or we're not immune. And if we are immune, why are we immune? And if we're not immune, what would the collapse of the Bronze Age look like if it happened to us today.
Well, yeah, and certainly, you know, so you write that it's never wise to bet against any of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. You know, so you're talking there about conquest, war, famine, and death. And it's I think what you say is likely that it's a multiple cause suspect, right?
Well, the key thing has always been on the collapse of the Bronze Age that it's such a wide, huge thing that everybody tries to figure out, well, what's big enough to affect something for so long over such a wide area? And most of the things that might do it seem to be hard to support with the evidence, or maybe the opposite's true. Mm. They find evidence for all kinds of things. So it's almost like there's too many needles in the haystack, and you don't know which one's the important one. In terms of the collapse of the Bronze Age, like which causes, you know, when you look at it and you wonder about things like environmental reasons, you wonder if there aren't echoes for today, whether it's overusing the land or famine or changes in aridity or patterns of desertification and those kinds of things. There is one of these wonderful things, though. There always seems to be some historical theory about the Bronze Age that's tied to whatever is in vogue during the time period the theory arises. So we happen to be climate's always been one of the theories, but we happen to be so aware of that right now that it's getting some extra attention maybe. But I can't help but look back on it and think, if we had some of those same problems, we'd have some of those same results happen to us too.
Well, yeah, and you talk about, there's a quote in the book, quote, what history is called invasions may sometimes have been more like migrations. This is certainly a topic that's like obsessing the world right now.
And it's hard for us to really see in a zoom out sort of pattern. So if you look at, for example, the whole migrant crisis over the last couple of years that's been swamping Europe and that's been such big news over there, it's really hard to put that in some sort of historical perspective and ask yourself how somebody writing 5 years from now would try to tie that into surrounding events and what they would make of it. And is it going to be significant down the road, or is it going to be a blip on their radar? How big do these migrations in the Bronze Age have to be for us to be aware of them and talking about them now, thousands of years later?
Can you talk to us about Nineveh, if I'm pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, Nineveh. So I have a fascination with the ancient world. And one of the things that's so fascinating about it is how long it was around. So if you wanted to date our modern world today to maybe the Renaissance, I'm just throwing that out there as a time when things seem to have gotten progressively better technologically, lifestyle-wise, that's about, 500 or 600 years? Mm-hmm. The city of Nineveh alone was around, well, not Nineveh, some of the older Assyrian cities were something like 1,000 years old. They came from a culture that had been around. They dated their kings to before the biblical flood. I mean, it's so freaking ancient, it reminds you of like something out of Tolkien or something. And they were around for so long. You know, I had a teacher once explain to me that they didn't have the same sort of scientific methods that we have, but they did have a sort of an observational science. So they would, like the Babylonians too, they would keep records, the Chinese too. And so they didn't know how to figure out hypotheses, but they had copious records, sometimes dating back centuries, that they could consult, and they could come up with frameworks of how to operate based on passed down written experience. And so these cultures like Assyria that had been literate for many, many, many centuries had these storehouses of ancient knowledge. I still have these fantasies that they'll break into something in the Middle East or something and find one of these libraries filled with ancient scrolls or cuneiform text that we could unleash. And it's like the ancient library at Alexandria becomes open to us or something like that. Nineveh is one of the great cities of the ancient world. It was the Assyrian capital for a while, and it was the center of their empire at its height. Mm. And when it fell, I think for maybe the biblical era people, it might have seemed like Mordor falling in Tolkien's time.
Yeah.
Although if you're Assyrian, it has a very different connotation.
Right. Well, and you also say that the Assyrians were often cast like we talk about Nazis in the biblical era.
You know, it must be awful to have been on the bad side of the biblical authors in the ancient world, because that's one of the few texts that survived and that most people are familiar with. So if you got bad publicity in the Old Testament, you're kind of screwed for life, I think. And the Assyrians were on the wrong side of a lot of that, because like a lot of other people, the folks who wrote the Bible came off on the wrong end of Assyrian diplomacy and warfare. But they lived during a time period where, you know, it was difficult to put armies together. It was expensive. And when you did, you punished people really harshly so you didn't have to come back and do it again soon. It was a very brutal period. The Assyrians were particularly good practitioners of things that imperial peoples would be good at ever since: crushing rebellions, making people pay a terrible price for usurping control, and, you know, making examples out of people, and then carving it in stone so it can still be in the British Museum today and you can look at it.
One of the reasons I love comedy so much is it gives you this weird little lens to look at stuff and maybe cause an insight. There's a comedy duo out of England called Mitchell and Webb, and they have this wonderful sketch where they're playing two Nazi soldiers and they're in a bunker and they're talking, and they just start looking around at the symbols on the other, on other uniforms of their comrades, and they would turn to each other and go, "Are we the baddies?"
Oh, I remember this. No, I remember. I do. I remember that. But you know what? That's a wonderful way to approach a subject that's very important, mm-hmm. which is most people do not consider themselves the bad guys.
No.
And if you went to and if you talk to the right people in Assyria, you're going to get a totally different view of Assyrian history than the Old Testament's going to give you. And that's the case always and everywhere, right?
Yeah. In so many different contexts. There's so much in this book. I do want to talk a bit about the plague, because there's a moment in this in when you're talking about it, and I'll read the quote because I hadn't considered this aspect of the plague. You write, quote, "In an era wherein people congregating together was so much more important than it is in our modern so-called connected world, people kept their distance from one another, creating one of the silent tragedies of this plague that they had to suffer virtually alone." Oh, my God. I mean, that's just like I hadn't really considered that would be the result. But I mean, that is the worst thing, that sort of no connection in the time you need the connection most.
You know, the funny thing about history for me, and I always like to say that history and science fiction meet at the instant that we're talking right now, right? The hard chronology of names and dates is right behind us. The many roads into a possible future are right in front of us, and we're at that crossroads right now. And when you look at something like the plague and what that did to places, that to me is a science fiction movie. And people, it's a trope today, right? I mean, let's do another Netflix series or something on some terrible pestilence. And yet, I can't decide if that makes us think about it more and understand it more and be aware of it more, or if that makes it seem less real. You know, I mean, the whole point of writing that stuff is to create a suspension of disbelief. And I feel like it's almost like the more we talk about the end of the world or the end of civilization or these things coming back, the more they seem like movie scripts or dramatizations. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, and you're the same age, roughly, we had the scare of nuclear war came back in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And back then they started to make a couple of high-profile TV specials or movies about a post-nuclear world. And it was a huge news event because it was like, okay, now we get to see dramatically what something like that might look like. But then it got to be done so often that it almost had the reverse effect, where you stopped paying attention to it and you stopped realizing exactly what, for example, the nuclear weapons that we still possess today and are just as dangerous or more than they ever were, what they can do to you. And when I was a kid, we thought about it all the time.
Yep.
Because they were still relatively fresh and new. We've been living with this threat for 65, 70 years now, you kind of forget it's out there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember like going to theaters to see the No Nukes concert, you know, and there was all
the
kinds
day
of activity.
After or something. What was the day after? There was a whole movie. Yeah.
So that's interesting, and it leads us a little bit more into the present. But this was all the writing around the U.S. dropping the bomb, the two bombs in Japan. And you talk about that, and I could not believe that Bertrand Russell was actually arguing for a preemptive nuclear strike on Russia by the United States. This is a sort of famous pacifist and really well-regarded thinker, but he was that scared of what that society would represent if they had these weapons at their disposal.
Yeah, Bertrand Russell was arrested in the First World War for pacifistic activity, but he had famously said that he had had a vision while walking around London of the city in ruins, the corpses everywhere, the British Museum, and the wealth and knowledge of what he said millennia of accrued achievements by humankind lying in ruins, and then he thought it would take 500 years to rebuild it. And when the stakes are that high, even a pacifist like Bertrand Russell can argue for a preventative nuclear war. The nuclear war thing to me is fascinating, because if you had sat down with people years ago and said, how did we ever get to a point where nuclear war seemed feasible, considering that it was only in when my mother was born in 1938, they didn't think bombing people in any way, shape or form ever was an okay thing.
No.
And by the time before she's a teenager, it's an accepted and understood method of war that could wipe out the major cities of the world. And it happened in like a decade.
Yeah.
So that is a huge change in the whole human attitude that opens up the door to stuff happening to you that our Victorian great grandparents could not have imagined culturally.
And the response, amazing. So you cite a couple of historians who wrote a book called To Win a Nuclear War, and they quote the Secretary of the Army, Kenneth Claiborne Royale, who said, and this is in response to like the idea of maybe we shouldn't use these bombs any further. He said, quote, "We've been spending 98% of all the money for atomic energy for weapons. Now, if we aren't going to use them, that doesn't make any sense," end quote. So this guy is arguing for Armageddon based on sunk cost fallacy, essentially, is what's going on there.
Well, it's worse than that. I mean, it's funny, because you would think, and when you read what the people who developed the atomic weapons and some of the debates they all had, I mean, they really thought this is a question for the humanity's best and brightest to sort of deal with, almost in a way where you focus like a laser beam all of humanity's intellectual potential on this potential existential threat. Mm. And instead, we have the typical things that we always deal with intruding, like, you know, the political races are coming up, and my goodness, couldn't these nuclear weapons save us in tax dollars? Do we have to build all these? I mean, it became the mundane concerns of regular existence intervened, as they always have. And I have to imagine that if you're a person who was worried and questioning whether humanity could handle the power of these new weapons, that could not have been a real confidence booster right there, because it just looks like we're a bunch of children playing with machine guns sometimes. And when you see what the power of these machine guns are, and when you see them demonstrated, like when you read about the Soviet nuclear test called Tsar Bomba, and you realize what that weapon was capable of, and you realize that there could be hundreds of those things, you start to see what people mean when they say that we actually have the power, if not to destroy the world, then to knock us back to a place where we would never recover our former glory again, which Nick Bostrom used as one of his examples of what an existential threat's definition was. It's not just being totally wiped out, but it's being knocked backwards and never being reaching your former level. So if in 500 years we were no longer capable of space flight, that would be an example.
Mm. And you talked too that this idea was essentially playing itself out on television when Kennedy had to deal with the Cuban Missile Crisis.
How weird is that? I mean, when you go and you read accounts from people, see, most of the planet didn't know what was going on, but there were these people who were in the know. They worked in the White House or whatever. And they were going home and really wondering whether they needed to worry about coming to work in the morning. Or, I mean, these are the kind of things it boggles the mind to think that people seriously believe that. And the first thing you want to say is, well, they certainly were worried about nothing, or they were over-exaggerating, or any, but they weren't. And the part that I try to get past in these stories is that we live under the same threat that they did. We've just kind of forgotten it. And that's what it looks like. What's that old line that there's nothing that clarifies the mind like a hanging in the morning, or something like that? And that was a hanging in the morning, and it's going to be tomorrow morning. And Jackie Kennedy had resisted being evacuated from the White House, saying she wanted to die with the president. Well, you don't think about those stakes, do you?
No. So the lesson we take away for the world we live in right now, and there was a fairly chilling moment when you talk about in the Truman era, basically, and I don't know who made the final decision, but that essentially the decision for pushing that button is the president, right? It's one person.
Yeah, and it's interesting how that developed, because it's a key change in American history that nobody really signed off on.
Right.
But you can understand the attitude. I mean, if you're going to have a nuclear war, how long do you have for Congress to debate it? How long? You know, we have a constitution written for technology 200 years ago, and now you have a world that by the late 1960s can be destroyed via missile in a matter of minutes. I mean, and when we say world destroyed, maybe it just means, like we said, knocked back a few generations, but it's bad enough. and you turn around and you try to figure out how you could handle that in the confines of a 200-year-old executive branch limiting sort of constitution that requires debate, the votes of a Congress. I mean, it was one of those things where technology may have superseded the written document, and we never really had a debate about it. I remember commenting and saying that the power to start World War III was still in the hands of a single individual. And somebody challenged me on it and said, well, there are secret protocols that you don't know about that would make it impossible for one person on their own having a bad day to launch a nuclear war. But if that's true, that's also been kept from the public and from other people. So answer to the question is that the necessities of the nuclear holocaust or the potential nuclear threat changed our form of government and did it sort of both quietly and yet in a way we all understand and notice today. It's not like it's a secret, but there was never any giant debate or vote or anything like that about it.
Yeah, so I think for obvious reasons, this concerns me, given the current occupant of the White House
and
his temperament, which is that of a child. And not that I don't think, I also, if you look at past history, this is someone who's very reluctant to get into these, you know, kinds of conflicts as well. But it's the not knowing and the idea that really it could be. And I think we have this in the, I don't know that you talk about in the book, but, you know, what I believe there is past history. Maybe it's in Russia, right, where an order was given and not followed. Am I remembering that right?
I think I'm remembering, yes. It was a Boris Yeltsin era thing, and it was a mistake. Yeah. Well, and that's the other part of the thing here is that the reason that you have a separation of powers and things like that in the Constitution is because it has nothing to do with the current occupant specifically. No single individual or single branch of government should be the ones with extreme war fighting powers and also have the power to take you to war, right? Yeah. In the old Constitution, one controls one controls the other. It's sort of like having the two nuclear keys. You have to turn at the same time to launch the missile. Because of the necessities of the atomic and then nuclear age, that got changed. And now in one branch of government, and theoretically, as far as we know, in one individual, you control the right to decide to go to war, and then you control the power to kill. I mean, think about this. There has never been a person as powerful as the current U.S. president. Never. The power to kill more people at the drop of a hat, ever. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you think of what Genghis Khan or Hitler or any of the worst people you can think of would do or might be able to do with this kind of power. And then we've concentrated it in the hands of a single branch or a single individual, and we don't even talk about it that much. Be interesting to bring back some of those physicists who worked on the original atomic bomb program and ask them for their thoughts on how things have gone since.
Oh, I think we know what they would say. All right. So we're coming close to the end, and I am going to ask you, as we ask every guest, for a yes and story, a time in your life where you normally would have said no, but instead you said yes and. But I'm curious. All right, you've just written this book, and you know, prior to this, the way I know your work is through listening to Hardcore History, which are these sort of wonderful spoken tales of you know that you know is very akin to the work in the book, but the book is different. And I'm wondering what was the choice of like, okay, I want to put this in book form, and this is what it means to put this in book form as opposed to the work I've been doing.
There is no question that there is definitely a need to translate what we do in the audio realm. And you work in audio, so you know it's a very different realm. And all you have to do is look at the transcripts to realize how different it is, because people have been asking us for years to just publish the transcripts, but they haven't seen the transcripts, and I have. And I talk like Donald Trump on the transcripts.
Right, exactly.
So they were going to need a lot of work regardless.
Not pretty.
The idea was, and so my yes, but answer was when people came to me and said, how about writing a book? I said, yes, but I'm very busy right now with this Hardcore History podcast. And they said, well, you have all of this material, though, surely sitting in the files, which I did. And they said, why don't you go back in there and see what sort of themes you can find, right? Are there things that connect the dots? And that's when I found out, like an inkblot test at a psychiatrist's office, that I'm really interested in knocking back civilization a few rungs, apparently. And, you know, it's a little dark, interesting piece about myself I've discovered through this book. But to answer your question is, with the podcast, I'm dealing with stuff that I've dealt with my whole adult working life. I've been working in broadcasting. A book is a very different animal, which I think every author would tell you. And I, you know, for me, it's like being a toddler again in terms of working in the media, because it's I feel like I'm learning the basics when I get out of my comfort zone. With audio, I'm in my comfort zone, in my realm. I know what I'm doing. With the book, I felt like a student again, and I was leaning on people heavily and trying to learn how one would, I mean, what do you do, for example, with all the tangents that I do in the podcast? In a book, that just looks like disorganized writing.
Right.
So that's an example of one of the many things that you have to try to figure out, okay, how does this translate through this different medium? And so in answer to your question, what you see is our attempt to translate the lots of questions and looking at these hard to quantify issues that are fascinating but hard to nail down or prove one way or the other. How does that look when you put it in something that's a much more cut and dry document, like a written form? I think that's what The End Is Always Near kind of looks like.
Yeah. So, and so, because we're in the audio format right now, I'm interviewing on Friday Joe Bowler, who is a Stanford professor in education and equity. And her new book is called The Limitless Mind. And it's, she works a lot with neuroscientists. And it's basically all the latest research on how we learn, which involves the need to make a lot of mistakes, the idea that collaborative learning is the best kind of learning. And it's fascinating in terms of looking at, like, oh no, this educational system that we've got is set up on old science. It's not set up on new science, and how hard it's been for her to get this stuff into the realm of, you really need to stop asking people to do rote memory skills and instead let them play with problems to tap, because the brain does change, and the brain gets smarter and grows, the neural pathways grow when you can tackle these difficult problems in a quest to get to the answer.
You know what? I think it's a larger societal question too that you bring up when you talk about that, because I do feel like there's a broad consensus that the way we teach and what we teach and the educational system we have is outdated and needs to change fundamentally and strongly. But I think we're seeing the limits of the flexibility in a system. I mean, like somebody had talked about government not working the other day. And I said, well, when was the last time that we sat down and tried to really improve it? I mean, I feel like we all feel like we're trapped by the inertia of our times. And you say, gosh, we should really change the way we educate kids. But there's a long distance between saying that and doing that, and maybe an impossible distance. And so I think that it's funny. I used to think that identifying problems was the issue in our society. And I think we've got a lot of good solutions that are being thrown out. Now it's a question of implementation and the ability of the society to be flexible enough and not be brittle. And I feel like the educational system is an example of something that's brittle, because it's so difficult to really change it on the fly.
Yeah.
And yet by the time you do the incremental stuff, it's outdated. And I really feel like fundamentally we still educate our kids. And I'm like the 9 millionth person to say this, so it's hardly groundbreaking. But for factory jobs from 75 years ago, as opposed to creative jobs or a foundation where you can pivot for an entire life. I mean, if I went to school to be a podcaster, there was no podcast when I was in school, but this is what I do for a living. So how do you train a person for a job that doesn't exist yet, right? You have to train them differently than when you train someone to work over at the car plant for the rest of their lives or something like that. So, I mean, I feel like a lot of people understand now that these things have to change. Now everybody's fighting the inertia of the way things are and seeing if we can do that. It's an interesting societal challenge that actually dovetails well with that Bronze Age collapse thing in the book, where, you know, the system becomes somewhat incapable of the amount of change that's necessary to get things done. Is there a point where it's like throwing a wrench in the machine? I don't know. But I think what your next guest is about to say to you on Friday is absolutely true. And I think a lot of people notice it, even people within the system. But I think even if we all wanted to, the challenge is, can we still change it?
Yeah, because it's scale, right? You talk about that in the book, that these civilizations just scaled, and you can't, it's very hard to be innovative when scaling.
Yeah, and you have to break lots of things, and you run the risk. I mean, it's like when you transfer from mainframe computers and you're the government to something more modern. Well, they're so patched up and they're so brittle. When are you going to make this giant change? And what if nothing works during the changeover? I mean, you run all kinds of risks, but if you don't, you're stuck with the old mainframe computers patched 1,000 times. So, I mean, I feel like one might make the case that our society now is like one of those shellfish that outgrows their shell and is going to eventually have to mold into a different shell. But in the meantime, there's going to be a period where we're vulnerable to the birds and all the critters out there during the shell you know, from one to the other. And I feel like that's kind of maybe where we're getting now. And it dovetails back into what you said about the nuclear codes being in the hands of one person, too. Either a system's going to evolve to protect us from the obvious downsides of that idea, or we're going to get the obvious downsides of that idea, and hopefully we'll have enough left to not make that same mistake twice.
Yeah. Okay. So you kind of almost gave us a yes and story, so I can let you off the hook unless you have another one for us.
That was my yes and.
Yeah,
story.
It was.
So you got it.
I got it. The book is called The End is Always Near. Dan Carlin, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.